Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the New York Public Library. God, the lights are glaring. I'm Jean Strauss, the director of the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers, and we're that's my fan club down front. We're sponsoring this lecture series in conjunction with the estate of Eric Goldman. Dan Kevlis is an advisor to the estate, and Alan Porter, who was executor of the estate. I'm very grateful to them for bringing this series to the library. The Eric Goldman estate gave the lecture series in memory of Goldman's wife, Joanna Jackson Goldman, which you probably read if you signed up to come to this series. And Dan gave a lovely talk about Joanna Jackson Goldman last week, but this week we're not going to do that. We're going to go right to the lecture. Except first, I want to thank Betsy Bradley, who's the deputy director of the Cullman Center and its manager of public programs, for pulling everything together to make this evening work so well, and also for putting together a lot of other programs that I'll tell you about really quickly that we'll be doing this spring. There are flyers out on a table as you leave about all these programs, so please take some. They're in many different colors. And also, if you are not already on our email list and you would like to get notifications about things we're doing in the future, there's a sign-up sheet on that table as well. On April 7th, we'll be hosting a panel called Mumbai, Terror, and Islamism, taking off from the events in Mumbai last fall and looking at their contexts and consequences. There will be two current Cullman Center fellows on the panel, Akhil Bilgrami and Hari Kunzru, and the journalist and expert on the Kashmir conflict, Basharat Peer, and also the Pakistani writer, Fauzia Afzal Khan. So that's April 7th. On April 30th, another former Cullman Center fellow, T.J. Stiles, will be talking with the novelist Kevin Baker about Stiles' new book, The First Tycoon, a biography of Cornelius Vanderbilt. On May 3rd, on May 3rd, the novelist and former Cullman Center fellow Ben Katcher and the composer Mark Mulcahy are going to put on the premiere performance of their new musical theater piece, A Czech Room Romance, a piece that we, the Cullman Center, commissioned. It's sold out, I'm glad and sorry to say, but there might be tickets the day of, and we may try to arrange a second evening, since it's too bad more people won't get to see this quite, I'm sure, fantastic thing. So if you want to see if we're going to do another one, take a look at our website, or keep watching our website. Finally, on May 27th, another former Cullman Center fellow, Danzy Senna, will be talking with the memoir writer Rebecca Walker about Senna's new nonfiction book, Where Did You Sleep Last Night? A Personal History, which looks back at the families of her Boston Brahmin mother and her African-American father, as well as at her own experience growing up. Many of you were here last week to hear Francis Fitzgerald's first and brilliant lecture in this series on the general topic, Politics in the Church, the Changing Face of Evangelical Christianity, of American Evangelicalism. That talk was called, Who Are the Evangelicals? This general subject could not be more important to talk about right now. Most of you probably saw the front page. David Loring Lewis is nodding at me from there. Most of you probably saw the front page story in last Sunday's New York Times about Obama's five pastors, all of them evangelicals. Frank Rich had a column that day about the culture wars and the religious right. And it's a great pleasure to introduce Frances Fitzgerald again to talk about this subject. I don't want to step on her time any more than I already have, so I'll be brief. Her excellent books include Fire in the Lake, The Vietnamese and the Americans in Vietnam, America Revised, History Textbooks in the 20th Century, Cities on a Hill, A Journey Through Contemporary American Cultures, and Way Out There in the Blue, Reagan, Star Wars, and the End of the Cold War. Fitzgerald has written for The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books over many years and on many subjects, including American evangelicalism. The title of her talk tonight is The Religious Right and Why It Grew. She'll speak for 45 or 50 minutes and has graciously agreed to take a few questions at the end. Last week we had microphones, but we never got them to people in time for their questions. So we are taping this event. Try to speak loudly, and perhaps Frances will repeat the question just so that everybody knows what she'll be talking about in response to the question. Thank you very much, and I turn the evening over to Frances Fitzgerald.
Thank you very much, Jean, and thank you all for coming. It's the religious right tonight. Next week, it's the sort of counter to the religious right, the what we call the new evangelical. So if you find yourself feeling depressed this evening, next week is the time to come. Well, I was present at the creation of the religious right. It was an accident, really. I was teaching for 3 weeks at a liberal arts college in Lynchburg, Virginia, in 1979, and one of the faculty members told me that I had to go and see Jerry Falwell's church on Thomas Road. He didn't say much about it, except that it was a fundamentalist church and that I, as a New Yorker, had to go and see it. So I went for services the next Sunday, expecting snake handlers or holy rollers or something along those lines. But what I found was a huge brick church with a white-columned portico and a lot of very respectable-looking people trying to find spaces to park their cars. The church held over 1,000 people, and when the service began, the large, comfortable pews were filled to the overflow. Looking around me, I noticed that the women had skirts considerably longer than mine, say to mid-calf, and that most of the men had held enormous Bibles. On the stage in front, a singing group was performing. One male soloist wore a bright green suit, which contrasted strikingly with the baby blue carpeting of the church. The young women had hairdos I'd seen on Charlie's Angels, which was a favorite television program of the time, and they also wore television makeup. As I later found out, the church services were televised and reached over 1 million viewers on cable stations. I hadn't realized there were so many fundamentalists in America. Eventually, Falwell, a heavyset man in a black Baptist suit with an air of sort of genial authority, appeared on the stage. He told us about his travels to New York and Washington, his encounters with politicians and other celebrities. He may have also told us about his college, Liberty Baptist, and his plans to build a university. I don't remember the sermon he preached that day, but I know it didn't sound anything like the sermons I'd heard from my Episcopalian bishop grandfather. At a certain point in his career, my grandfather had banned the hymn Onward Christian Soldiers from the repertoire of his church. But Falwell always seemed to equate evangelism with military operations. In one memorable sermon, he said, speaking of his own conversion, "Radio became the artillery that broke up my fallow ground and set me to thinking and searching, but the local church became the occupation force that finished the job and completed the task that the artillery had begun." It's important, he said, to bombard our territory, to move out near the coast and shell the enemy. But ultimately, some Marines have to march in. He went on in this vein for several paragraphs. As I later discovered, Falwell and his people didn't consider anyone a Christian who didn't share their own brand of fundamentalism. And I understood this when I heard one of his college administrators promise that Liberty Baptist would one day have a Christian football team equal to that of Notre Dame. Falwell, though I didn't realize it at the time, was in the process of founding the Moral Majority. A year or so before, a group of political organizers, Paul Weyrich, Ed McAteer, Howard Phillips, and others, who call themselves the New Right, had begun an effort to mold conservative Christians into a political voting bloc. They claimed a potential constituency of 50 million Protestant evangelicals, 30 million morally conservative Catholics, and plus a large number of Mormons and Orthodox Jews. They did not really expect to enlist this whole constituency or to create a religious political party. Rather, they expected that a campaign focused on such concerns as abortion, homosexuality, and the proposed Equal Rights Amendment would swing sufficient numbers of evangelicals and Catholics to change their normal voting patterns and the electoral results, thereby swelling the ranks of the Republican Party and at the same time moving the party to the right. To that end, they enlisted several right-wing televangelists and formed political organizations around them. The fiery Texas preacher James Robison and a group called the Religious Roundtable were to appeal to Southern Baptists. On the West Coast, Robert Billings and others started the Christian Voice, aimed at Pentecostal denominations. The activists also wanted a fundamentalist champion. Falwell was interested, and in June 1979, the Moral Majority came into being with the goal of mobilizing religious conservatives and registering them to vote. Well, of all the televangelists that they enlisted at the time, Falwell proved the most dedicated to politics and the most energetic. So while he appealed mainly to fundamentalists, he became for a time the lead spokesman for the movement as a whole. In explaining this new movement, Falwell and the other preachers spoke of their sense of crisis, their belief that America would not survive long as a free nation. The moral decay and the loss of spiritual values that were weakening the country and leaving it vulnerable to communist aggression. Well, in the late 70s, that was a period of reaction in the country generally. The civil rights movement and the black power movement, the feminist movement, the gay rights movement, the sexual revolution, all these disturbances of the social order were profoundly unsettling to many Americans, as were the often unruly student protests against the Vietnam War. Then, too, the American defeat in Vietnam stunned many Americans. And in Washington, conservatives went on the offensive, charging that America was falling behind the Soviets in the nuclear arms race, that the country was weakening in its commitment to the struggle against communism. Then, of course, came the revolution of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, and the taking of American embassy personnel as hostages. The agenda of the Moral Majority wasn't all that different from that of many other conservatives of the time. As head of the organization, Falwell did his best to keep his own particular religious views out of the picture and to present himself as a mainline conservative. He didn't always succeed, but his official agenda wasn't all that different from Ronald Reagan's agenda in his 1980 presidential campaign, except as a matter of emphasis. The core issues of the Moral Majority were abortion, gay rights, the Equal Rights Amendment, and the banning of prayer in the public schools. But Falwell also called for a stronger national defense, for lower taxes, less government, an end to welfareism. In addition, he spoke out against the SALT II Treaty limiting nuclear weapons, the Panama Canal Treaty, sanctions against Rhodesia. He also called for stronger support for Israel. Reagan, of course, won the election, and 4 years later, he declared that the crisis was over, the national decline had been stemmed, and it was morning again in America. He was reelected in a landslide because whatever he had or hadn't done in terms of policy, he had restored a sense of national confidence. After that, secular conservatives went about their business, lobbying for more defense spending, lower taxes, the defeat of affirmative action, and so forth. But the sense of crisis was over. Not so on the religious right. In all the years from then until now, religious rights spokesmen, Falwell, Pat Robertson, James Dobson, and many others, have more or less vehemently proclaimed that America is in a state of serious moral decline. And they've promised that without immediate action on abortion, gay rights, so on, freedom will be lost and the country will succumb to its enemies. Secular commentators often take this for hyperbole, but it's more than that. It's a part of a worldview. And it's this worldview that distinguishes the religious right, essentially the evangelical right, from other conservatives. So that's really what I'm going to be talking about today. David Gushee, who's an evangelical and a professor of Christian ethics at the School of Theology in Mercer University, has observed that right-wing evangelicals are characterized by, quote, a mood of angry nostalgia. In his book, The Future of Faith in American Politics, published last year, he tells us that in recent decades, conservative evangelicals have, quote, been deeply attracted to the narrative of cultural despair. I'm going to quote him at some length on this subject, and the internal quotations are his. He writes, "Normally the story begins with the rise of secularism in the 1960s, the abandonment of prayer in the schools, the Roe v. Wade decision, all leading to an apocalyptic decline of American culture that must be arrested soon before it is too late, and, quote, God withdraws his blessing from America. The evangelical right pines for a lost world of strong heterosexual nuclear families, culture-wide moral clarity, and more or less established Christianity. As so often happens, this sad hunger for a lost past is frequently accompanied by a deep anger at the perceived source of its disappearance: liberals, feminists, secularists, homosexual activists, abortion doctors, and so on. And one must not discount the role of fear in this potent brew. Fear for one's children, fear for the loss of Christian hegemony in American culture, even fear of some kind of cataclysmic divine judgment. The solution offered is a return to a strong Christian America characterized by traditional family values and gained through determined political action. No one who seeks to understand conservative Christians can dare overlook these potent emotive sources of its passion and its appeal to many Americans." Gushee goes on to talk about the mythologizing of the founding fathers as evangelical Christians, the difficulty that conservatives have in coming to terms with religious and cultural pluralism. He decries their, quote, arrogant disdain for those who do not see it our way, the angry culture war rhetoric, and the slash and burn attacks on those who disagree with us. This is a pretty good account of religious right attitudes, and remember, it's by an evangelical, and it's an account that many evangelicals today would agree with. But where do these attitudes come from? Well, Gushee doesn't explain at this juncture, but the fact is that the evangelical right is a product of the fundamentalist movement of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In the 1980s, fundamentalists like Falwell were a small subset of evangelicals. George Marsden, a prominent evangelical historian, once called them evangelicals who are mad about something. But from the time of its emergence in the 19th century, the fundamentalist movement proved extremely influential, and today a fundamentalist strain runs through a large and diverse group of evangelical denominations, some of which belong to theological traditions completely different from fundamentalism proper. So what is fundamentalism? What are the key doctrinal markers of the fundamentalist strain in evangelicalism? Essentially, there are two. One of them is biblical inerrancy. In 1980, Falwell defined inerrancy in this way, and I quote, "The Bible is absolutely infallible, without error in all matters pertaining to faith and practice, as well as in areas such as geography, science, and history." A stunning statement, and even more stunning is the corollary that all propositions about faith or science or history must meet the test of biblical truths or they can't be true. Why are right-wing evangelicals so wedded to the unfettered free enterprise system? Well, David Gushee would give you an historical explanation, but Falwell's explanation was, the free enterprise system is clearly outlined in the book of Proverbs. The other doctrinal marker is the eschatology known as premillennial dispensationalism. That's a mouthful, and I'll get into it later, but you're doubtless familiar with some aspects of it, as Armageddon and the rapture of Christians into the air. There's a third marker, and it's the mood of angry nostalgia, which has to do with the experience of fundamentalists in their conflict with modernists in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The religious right really can't be understood without this history. Covering the Scopes trial in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925, H.L. Mencken famously wrote of fundamentalists as yokels, peasants, hillbillies, and mountaineers, and those were the kindest words he used about them. But the people in that small town in Tennessee were not fundamentalists, but merely followers of the old-time evangelical religion of the South. Fundamentalism, properly speaking, was a new religious movement that developed in reaction to modernist thinking in the northern churches. It was a northern phenomenon. Modernist thinking did not exist in southern churches at that time, and it was something quite different from the old-time religion. In the last lecture, I talked about how the revivals of the Second Great Awakening turned almost all Protestants in this country into evangelicals and made evangelical Protestantism the dominant cultural force in the country. I noted that a division within evangelical ranks opened before the Civil War, and mainly between Northerners and Southerners. Evangelicalism was never monolithic, and certainly not at the level of the seminaries. Yet at the popular level, most evangelicals believed that America was a Christian, read Protestant, nation, guided by providence and a model to mankind. They believed in the economics of rugged individualism, they believed in plain common sense, and they believed that what the Bible said was true. Yet after the Civil War, new intellectual currents from Europe coursed through northern society. Modernist thinking was essentially secular thinking, and in the universities, it removed religion from the disciplines of science, social science, history, and so forth. As many Christians saw it, the world of knowledge, or simply the world, was being desacralized and chopped up into bits. For the Protestant clergy, as for the Catholics, the most disruptive elements of modernist thinking were Darwinian evolution and the higher biblical criticism. The first you know about. The second was the practice begun in German universities in the 1830s, of treating the scriptures like all other ancient texts and examining them through the lenses of modern, i.e. secularized disciplines, history, philology, literary analysis, and so forth. Among other things, scholars found that none of the original manuscripts of the Gospels, much less the books of the Old Testament, survived, and that many changes had been made in the various iterations of the surviving texts. They found that the biblical authors had made errors of history and geography. They found that many of the stories in the Old Testament had parallels in stories told in non-Hebraic cultures of the same periods. They then asked themselves about the cultural and theological conditioning of the authors, including those who wrote the Gospels and the Epistles of St. Paul. Biblical scholarship and the implications of Darwinian evolution took some time to get from the universities into the churches, but when they did, many Protestant clergymen adapted their theology to this new thinking. Many, for example, concluded that the account of creation in Genesis was a myth, that is, not a simple untruth, but a marvelous and meaningful story. The Bible, as they began to understand it, was filled with myths, sagas, and stories that held spiritual or moral truths, but were not to be taken literally. They went so far as to question the virgin birth of Jesus, his miracles, and his physical resurrection. The Bible, they concluded, was not in itself a revelation from God, but rather the witness that fallible mortals made to his revelations. They further concluded that in reading the Bible, yesterday or today, people would understand it differently given their own cultural and historical conditioning. Their views were differently nuanced, but in broad strokes, the Protestantism that the modernist clergy developed was much less supernaturalistic than traditional Protestantism, and it was focused on the ethical teachings of Jesus. To conservative Protestants, Darwinian evolution and the new biblical criticism seem nothing less than apostasy. A reaction came quickly. It came most authoritatively from the conservative Presbyterian theologians at Princeton, from Calvinists who saw themselves as custodians of Reformed orthodoxy, that is, of the Protestantism of the Reformation. These theologians, Charles Hodge, his son, and their successors at Princeton, B.B. Warfield and J. Gresham Machen, took the view that if the Bible contained any errors, it could not be God's word, and if it were not literally God's word, it could not be a secure source of religious authority. They therefore proposed that the Bible was verbally inspired by God, virtually dictated by him, and utterly errorless. Over several decades, they defended this position with great intellectual energy and passion. The position, however, was not that of Luther or Calvin. It was closer to that of the 17th century Reformed scholastics. But as the argument with the modernists went on, the Princetonians added new elements. In the late 1880s and early 1890s, B.B. Warfield carried on a highly publicized debate with two fellow Presbyterians, in which he insisted that the scriptures were not merely infallible as guides to faith and practice, but infallible in matters of science and in all their incidental historical details. So who would guess that Falwell's view of the Bible came from Princeton? Warfieldism, as one might call it, became very popular with conservative clergymen, particularly those who gathered around the great revivalist of the period, Dwight Moody. The rift within Protestantism in the North came not just over modernist thinking, but over what came to be known as the social gospel. Towards the end of the 19th century, a number of influential clergymen began to face up to the consequences of unregulated industrialization, the growing inequalities of wealth, the horrendous conditions for factory workers and poor in the slums of the big cities. The middle-class churches, they felt, were complacent about this social disaster. To them, it seemed obvious that the Old Testament prophets and Jesus would not just call for personal salvation, but for social reform. In a secular vein, these preachers rejected the laissez-faire economics that prevailed in the Gilded Age and joined the progressives of Teddy Roosevelt's party in insisting that the government should take an active role in helping the poor and restraining unbridled capitalism. As Christians, they saw reform as a means of Christianizing the social order and bringing the kingdom of God on earth, bringing in the kingdom of God on earth in preparation for Christ's return. Conservative clergymen, in particular, the biblical inerrantists gathered around Dwight Moody, rejected this view entirely. Social change, they insisted, could only come through revivals, through changing the hearts and the lives of individuals. The rest was all a matter of externals. Well, both sides in this debate looked at each other as deviants, though in fact the commission to both social and individual reform were deeply embedded in their common Protestant tradition and in the preaching of the great antebellum revivalist, Charles Finney. But at this point in history, Protestants divided into what Martin Marty calls the public party and the private party, the social reformers on one hand, and those concerned only with evangelism and with personal morality on the other. In fact, well before the end of the 19th century, Moody and his followers had simply given up on the prophetic tradition known as postmillennialism, or the idea espoused by Charles Finney and Jonathan Edwards that man could build God's kingdom and prepare the way for Christ's return within history. "I look upon the world as a wrecked vessel," Moody declared. "God gave me a lifeboat and said to me, 'Moody, save all you can.'" Further, he and his followers became premillennial dispensationalists. Now, premillennialism has as old a history in America as postmillennialism. Many Puritan divines, Increase Mather among them, felt that history was on a downward course. People were falling away from religion. Civilization was descending into barbarism. From their reading of the scriptures, they concluded that if Christians didn't return to the true faith and reform the society, God in his anger would destroy the world. And only after that would Christ's millennial reign be established on the earth. Such sermons, essentially shape up or God will punish us all, were known as Jeremiads. But dispensationalism was something different. The construction of John Nelson Darby, a dissenter from the Church of Ireland, it was a complete account of human history and of God's plan for the future. From his reading of the Bible, mainly the books of Daniel and Revelations, Darby concluded that history was divided into ages, or dispensations, each defined by a different covenant between God and man. The sixth dispensation was the age of the church, and the seventh, the millennial reign of Christ in Jerusalem. The seventh would be heralded by the apostasy of the churches and the decline of Christian civilization. Then sacred time would take over. First, Christ would come suddenly and without warning and rapture all true Christians into the air. There would follow a great tribulation for the rest of humanity that would last for 7 years. In this period, the Antichrist, a false prophet, would appear to lead the apostate churches. The beast would appear in the form of a powerful political leader who would unite the nations into a new Roman Empire. The Jews would return to Israel, and some would be converted. Then the worst part of the tribulations would take place. Finally, Christ would come with an army of saints to defeat the beast and the Antichrist at the Battle of Armageddon. Well, this scenario must seem a bit bizarre to you. But after Darby preached it in the United States in the 1860s and 70s, it caught on in this country in an astonishing way. Dwight Moody preached dispensationalism, so did all of his successors. Dispensationalism was taught in Bible conferences and Bible institutes, and in 1908 it was codified in the Scofield Reference Bible with handy notes and cross references. The narrative, after all, had its attractions for conservatives. True Christians would be immediately saved, and apostates, liberals and modernists, would be condemned to the tribulations. Plus, the rapture was a great tool for evangelism. I mean, who would want to be left behind to suffer? Beyond that, the scenario was a meta-narrative on a scale with the secular meta-narratives of the 19th century, as Darwinian evolution and Marxism. As in Marxism, people could grasp where they stood in history by looking for the signs of the times all around them. The narrative brought history under control in a period when many Christians feared that society was out of control, and it made the Bible the central reference point. Looking at current events, dispensationalists didn't have to worry about the mundane forces that led, say, to the Haymarket riots. They could simply fit these events into biblical prophecies. Further, as the decades passed, these prophecies seemed to be coming true. One of the names for the beast was Ross, and after the Russian Revolution in 1917, it seemed clear to them that Ross was communist Russia. The creation of the State of Israel in 1948 also fit into the end time scenario. The Jews were returning to the Holy Land. Well, biblical inerrancy and dispensationalism were not the only anti-modernist movements of the late 19th century. In response to the draining away of supernaturalism from the churches came the holiness movement and Pentecostalism. Both derived from the Methodist tradition, but both were in many ways novelties. Holiness churches stressed the indwelling of the Holy Spirit and the possibility of growing to Christian perfection through fervent piety and obedience to a strict code of personal morality. James Dobson comes from this tradition. Pentecostals, for their part, propose that the Holy Spirit continues to work miracles among us today, as it did among the apostles at Pentecost. Faith healing and speaking in tongues are among these miracles. Both of these movements were populist movements that began well outside the seminaries. Pentecostalism attracted both black and white Americans, and it's the fastest growing religious movement in this world today. Pat Robertson and Sarah Palin come from this tradition. Both the Holiness and Pentecostal churches were, of course, theologically conservative, and both adopted dispensationalist prophecies. But both were far more concerned with the experience of God than with doctrine. You might call them the emotion party, as opposed to the doctrine or the truth party. Fundamentalism proper came from the Truth Party, from a group of hardline conservatives who had first gathered around Dwight Moody. Most were Baptists, Presbyterians, and Congregationalists, or those who had a strong admixture of Calvinism in their theological traditions, and most were dispensationalists. Beginning in 1875, these preachers held annual Bible conferences in Niagara Falls to excoriate modernism and to lay down the law about the fundamental beliefs of Christianity. And biblical inerrancy was always the first among them. Between 1910 and 1915, some of these preachers oversaw the publication of a 12-volume paperback series designed to rally conservative Christians. The series was called The Fundamentals, and eventually militant anti-modernists took to calling themselves fundamentalists. After World War I, in a period of conservative reaction in the country, the fundamentalists went on the offensive and attempted to take control of the major Protestant denominations in the North. The fundamentalists had considerable strength among the Baptists and Presbyterians, and they might have succeeded in these denominations had they been the least bit tolerant of differences. But they saw themselves as waging war for Christianity, and they threatened to purge all those who disagreed with them. The liberals fought back on theological grounds, but they took their stand on tolerance and inclusion. And this appealed to Protestants in the pews, most of whom didn't belong to either party. So by 1926, the liberals essentially won. In the meantime, however, some fundamentalists, as William Jennings Bryan, the old populist leader, looked for support in the South, where modernism had not yet made inroads. And they found it among politicians belonging to the traditionally conservative Southern churches. In the early 1920s, several Southern states passed laws banning the teaching of evolution. The American Civil Liberties Union decided on a test case in Dayton, Tennessee, where a school teacher named John Scopes had defied the state statute. In the trial, the famous criminal lawyer Clarence Darrow faced off against William Jennings Bryan, who appeared as counsel for the Attorney General of Tennessee. Framed as a duel between science and biblical literalism, the trial became a media circus, a huge spectacle for the country at large. Darrow lost the case, but he managed to expose Bryan's ignorance of science and of many passages in the Bible. He turned Bryan into a figure of fun. The fundamentalists, for their part, wouldn't defend Bryan because the old politician finally confessed that he didn't think that every word in the Bible should be taken literally. In what seemed the measure of his defeat, Bryan died a few days later. After this debacle of the Scopes trial and their failure to take over the northern churches, fundamentalists seemed to disappear. They were culturally marginalized as Hicks and Rubes, but as the anthropologist Susan Harding has shown, they collaborated in their own marginalization. The northern militants left their denominations, created separatist churches, and dropped out of the national conversation. By the 1950s, many in the north, at least, believed that fundamentalism was a remnant of rural backwardness that was gradually fading away in the bright light of modernity. Fundamentalists, for their part, pictured themselves as the saving remnant, but also as outcasts, strangers in Babylon. In fact, in the mid-century, the fundamentalist movement grew and flourished, and as time went on, more Northern Baptists left their denominations, formed networks of independent separatist churches, built Bible colleges, and evangelistic organizations in many parts of the country. By the early 1980s, just one of these networks, the Bible Baptist Fellowship, to which Jerry Falwell's church belonged, had nearly 3,000 churches and well over a million members. Further, fundamentalism proved extremely influential, particularly in the South, which in the 1950s and 60s began to urbanize, industrialize, and attract immigrants from the rest of the country. As the sociologist Nancy Ammerman has shown, many rural Southern Baptists who moved into the cities and suburbs adopted fundamentalist beliefs, strict biblical inerrancy, and dispensationalism. Encountering the modern secularized world, they also acquired the dogmatic militancy of fundamentalism, absent in their rural churches. In 1979, militants flying the standard of biblical inerrancy captured the presidency of the Southern Baptist Convention and began a takeover of its seminaries and key agencies. The hardliners remain largely in control of the convention today. Visiting Falwell's church in 1979, I was surprised by the sheer number of fundamentalists. But what surprised political scientists and pollsters was the emergence of the religious right. The fact that fundamentalists, Southern Baptists, Pentecostalists, and other conservative Protestants were mobilizing for electoral politics. Fundamentalists, after all, had, with very few exceptions, anti-communist crusades in California, school textbook controversies in Texas. Apart from those things, they'd taken almost no part in politics since the 1920s. Separation for them had meant not just separation from the liberal churches, but from American culture, which they saw as corrupt, impious, and anyway, not designed to last for very much longer. As for the Southern Baptists, they, like most other Southern Protestants, had since the 1830s observed a doctrine known as the spirituality of the church. Designed to immunize the churches from any responsibility for slavery, the doctrine proposed that the church, as a spiritual body, held itself above the mundane affairs of state. The Southern churches did agitate for temperance and the Blue Laws, but by and large, they didn't interfere with the larger social and economic arrangements, such as those that perpetuated slavery and segregation. In 1965, Falwell, a fundamentalist and a Southerner, gave a sermon about the civil rights movement in which he said, "Nowhere are we commissioned to reform the externals. Believing in the Bible as I do, I would find it impossible to stop preaching the pure saving gospel of Jesus Christ and begin doing anything else, including fighting communism or participating in the civil rights reform." No doubt he was sincere, but the sermon was overtly racist. He began by questioning the nonviolent intentions of Martin Luther King. He later asked why church leaders concerned themselves with the, quote, alleged discrimination against Negroes instead of with alcoholism, because he said, there are almost as many alcoholics as there are Negroes. Well, 15 years later, 1980, Falwell called this sermon of his false prophecy, and he lauded Dr. King's efforts as noble. By then, he had formed the moral majority and was deeply engaged in politics. So, too, were a number of prominent Southern Baptist leaders. In fact, the first four presidents of the Southern Baptist Convention, elected after the militants took over in 1979, were also founding members of the religious right. Well, they all should have thanked Dr. King. They didn't go into politics to oppose civil rights, but the success of the civil rights movement had liberated them from their own bondage in the doctrine of the spirituality of the church. It freed them from their need to defend the status quo. It gave the ministers back their voices and permitted them to join the national political conversation. And they joined it at this point, of course, as Republicans. For fundamentalists and those they influenced, there was one more doctrinal hurdle to be jumped before they could get into politics, and that was dispensationalism. For much of the past century, pastors and evangelists, Billy Graham among them, had been preaching that all attempts to reform the society, all politics, were useless because the course of history was hopelessly regressive and the end was nigh. This was a particular problem at the time. In the 1970s, with the publication of Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth, which was a huge bestseller, dispensationalism entered its boom years. It's estimated that 10 to 15 million people accepted it as doctrine, and another 10 to 15 million were entranced by the narrative. In the late 1970s, fundamentalist preachers were finding signs of the end times in everything from the rise in the divorce rate to Jimmy Carter's, quote, giveaway of the Panama Canal. Falwell himself was predicting that Russia would soon attack Israel, and after it was defeated, the Antichrist would move into the Middle East and unleash the Great Tribulation. I remember him showing his congregation a video of himself in Israel walking along the site where the Battle of Armageddon was to take place. And lecturing from there. Well, in 1980, the solution came from Hal Lindsey and from Tim LaHaye, who was later the author of the Left Behind novels. I'm sure a lot of you have heard of them, where you know it all starts with cars crashing because their drivers are raptured into the air and so forth. They're great adventure stories. In any case, LaHaye, in a book called The Battle for the Mind, written in 1980, proposed that liberal humanists were trying to take over America, and if they succeeded, they would create a mini-tribulation, a pre-tribulation tribulation. But this tribulation, unlike the big one, could be averted if Christians acted with vigor, if they prayed and witnessed, if they joined pro-moral organizations, if they educated themselves, and created a national drive to register Christian voters. Falwell quickly took up this idea of a window within the end times in which Christians could play a positive role. He began to preach Jeremiah ads. If Christians led the battle against the breakdown of the traditional family and for a stronger national defense, God would save the country until the rapture came. So, to the amazement of political scientists, the fundamentalists and their allies rushed into the political fray. Marginalized since the 1920s, they rushed in with their old political and social views almost intact. They had been separated from the world since then. Falwell's traditional family, the one he preached, the one his family pastors preached, involved the submission of wives to their husbands as to Jesus. Falwell's laissez-faire economics would have seemed old-fashioned to Teddy Roosevelt, and his view of the United States in the world came from a period when Europe, decadent Europe, seemed remote, and the United States could freely send expeditionary forces into Cuba and the Philippines. In short, Jerry Falwell's golden age was not the 1950s. It was the mid-19th century, before the advent of the modern economy, before the advent of religious and cultural pluralism. Also intact was fundamentalist anger. Falwell, for one, spoke to his own audiences, not to the public at large, about waging a holy war for Christian America with a disciplined, charging army of the church. Well, Falwell, who died in 2007, was also a man of the late 20th century. Ambitious, energetic, Eager to play a role in the larger world, he used modern technologies, television, direct mail, to build his church and his movement. And in the mid-1970s, he told a meeting of fundamentalist preachers, quote, "For too long we have sat back and said politics are for the people in Washington. Business is for those on Wall Street, and religion is our business. But you cannot separate the sacred and the secular. We need to train men of God in our schools who can go on to Congress, can go on to be directors in the largest corporations, who can become lawyers and businessmen and those important people in tomorrow's United States. If we're going to turn this country around, we have to get God's people mobilized, and we have to do it quickly." Well, Falwell couldn't have it both ways. He couldn't have both a discipline-charging army and a bunch of country club-going business executives. He tried his best, and he himself didn't change very much at all in his life. But it couldn't be done. And the university he built is evidence of it. Liberty University today has 12,000 students. It has a law school, and its college graduate students going on into business, science, and medicine. Its students don't yet seem to have scaled the heights of the large corporations or of Congress. Its most prestigious alumni, according to the website, are NFL players. Yet this effort to train men of God for worldly professions has created intellectual and social tensions for its students that their parents did not have to face. For example, a half of the students aren't men of God, but women. These women have given up their mid-calf length dresses for blue jeans. They're training for careers, and they have a seriously strong basketball team. Liberty is otherwise somewhat diverse. According to its website, 20% of its students are minorities or international students. Liberty, of course, teaches creationism, but it teaches evolutionary biology too, because the Virginia Board of Education and the graduate schools of science and medicine require it. This is not necessarily good news for liberals. If Liberty gets more serious about its academic training, it may eventually produce new generations of educated conservatives, just as Falwell hoped. But at least its students will have been liberated from the enclosed world their parents grew up in, and from their sense of alienation from the rest of us that produced the religious right. I'm going to stop now because I want to hear your questions. Last week, your questions were so good. I haven't talked at all about religious right politics. We can do that now. But just bear in mind that fundamentalists are not a majority within the evangelical community, and that the religious right has only gained power within it by reducing its message to a few discrete issues, as abortion and gay rights. The generational change that's occurred within the evangelical community as a whole is my subject for next week. Thank you. Could you speak?
Yeah, there's like, there. Dan Brown back.
The intellectuals become Catholics.
Right. And I'm wondering if you could just comment on that tension between the kind of, you know, everybody saying sotto, you know, below their breath, well, they're going to hell, but they're on our team for the time being. And I mean, you know, and you see that kind of conflict boiling up where
well,
people have to disavow, well, yes, I mean, I like you, but you're going to hell.
Well, this is a part of the change that's been going on since the 1980s. And part of this, I talked about the tensions that these students experience when they go to Liberty University. Well, similarly, when the evangelical right went into politics, it started experiencing the same kind of tensions by going out into the world. Now, the religious right organizes. I'm talking about the Paul Weyricks, and you know, not the Falwell. Weyrick was a conservative Catholic, and he put abortion on the list because he felt that that would be the way to unify Catholics and evangelicals. But what's interesting about that was that before then, we're talking 1978 now, very few evangelicals actually worried about abortion. And the Southern Baptist Convention actually came out for Roe v. Wade. Why did they do that? Well, if you talk to the sort of hardliners today, they'll tell you that the SBC was then controlled by a bunch of liberals. Not quite. It was very sort of moderate, a more moderate group was in control. One of the big reasons they did it because of their anti-Catholicism of the period. So, in this effort to create a sort of a larger Christian alliance of conservative Christian alliance, all kinds of lines started getting blurred. Today, evangelicals are far more anti-abortion than Catholics are, according to the polls. And so that's one part of it. But the other part is, just as you were saying, is that these theological lines have been crossed and recrossed and crossed and recrossed. Now, this is something that's happened throughout American history. If you try and trace the history of American Protestantism, you go crazy because it's always going like this. But the Protestant Catholic divide was always really strongly there from the beginning. Arthur Schlesinger called it the strongest prejudice in American history because it went on forever. So that has been going, and it's been going often not as a result of anybody, you know, seminarians saying, now we have to consider the gospel in this way or that, although some of that goes on, but merely by the process of experience, I think. People allying with each other, both on the left and the right, the left of the evangelical world I'm talking about, and the right. So a lot of these lines are being crossed. The evangelical world is not the same today as it was in 1980.
Yeah. I was interested in biblical inerrancy and how the fundamentalists handle this. There's so many biblical passages, you know, it's harder for a rich man to go to heaven than it is for a camel.
They would take that as a metaphor. That they would take as a metaphor. there's.
They face those, you know, in the Sermon on the Mount and so on. They face those head on, at least in seminaries, or do they just sort of ignore them? Or?
Jonas was swallowed by the whale. Yes, they do, and how they manage that is not entirely clear to me. I have never sat through this, these arguments that go on about Genesis 1, I mean, that's really key. you know, you cannot. Here is Richard Land, who is the official in charge of public policy for the Southern Baptist Convention. He went to a conservative Bible school, but he has a PhD from Oxford. He has to argue for creationism. He must, because this is where the militants drew their line. And you know, the liberals in the Southern Baptist Convention say this is all political, really. You know, you say, you know, people in the pews, you know, believe that the Bible is inerrant without thinking about it, right? So that's what you're doing. Whereas if once you get into seminary, you have a very difficult time dealing with the biblical scholarship and all the rest of it. It's a confusing state of the world. I mean, evangelicalism has always had a major populist side to it. And Southern Baptists have always, before this happened really, determined that every congregation should have, every person, but every congregation as well, should have liberty of conscience to decide what they themselves chose about such issues as inerrancy and so forth. But it's this hard line that has come down from the top that has made such difficulty at the moment. And that's the fundamentalist part of it. It's not really about, you know, old time religion, as I say. Yes, I'm sorry, I get to be loud.
Is there such a thing as a religious left? And if so, why are they not able to election?
Well, you're talking about an evangelical left, essentially. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, because there is, but it's very, very small. I'm going to be talking about this next week. I'm sorry, but basically, evangelicals don't like to be call themselves left. So, what the word is now is centrist or new evangelicals or something, David Gushee, who's one of these people, and I was quoting from a book in which he is essentially making a case for the evangelical center. Well, you look at him try and find the left. He can't. There's one person he can find, and that's Jim Wallis, head of Sojourners. And otherwise, Gushee can't find anybody the left of him. Which means that he's pretty far left himself as far as the right is concerned. You see what I mean? Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Could you address the situation at the Air Force Academy and tell us who these people are who have apparently gotten control where it's hard not to be a Christian if you're in flight training or if you're going through the university?
Oh, well, you know, this is the real difficulty, I think, of chaplaincy in the armed forces generally, but the Air Force seems to have a particular problem with it, and particularly in where their academy is, which is in Colorado Springs, which is the sort of center of the evangelical right. I mean, Dobson's Focus on the Family is there, you know, New Life Church. There's endless evangelical groups around there, and it's simply that some of the officers are evangelicals, and they're used to speaking in this way. They are not used to drawing lines in the way that liberal Protestants and others do. So, I think that a lot of it is probably simply unconscious, and it is built into their DNA, as they like to say. They use this word DNA a lot. I don't know why. to convert, to spread the gospel. So that's what happens. And then, you know, finally somebody stands up and says, no more of that. So then we go into this, you know, this difficult process. That's what's really all it's about. But it's not nothing. I mean, boy. Yes.
Talk a little bit about the relationship between the religious right and the Southern strategy. And secondly, you mentioned modernism is a world desacralized and chopped up into bits. That makes me think of the Weberian paradox where, you know, you need religion to create a commercial society, but then as a society becomes more affluent, it loses a sense of religion at all. And that's kind of what happened to mainline Protestant faiths. I wonder whether or not, you know, evangelicals, by aligning themselves with capitalism, are going to be actually undermining themselves in the long run. Could you comment?
Sure. There are two totally different questions. And the first one, because I got so interested in the
Southern strategy.
Oh, Southern strategy. Okay. If you'd been here last week, what I did was talk about the division that occurred between Northern and Southern evangelicals in the 1830s, essentially. And of course, from before the Civil War and on ever after until the Civil Rights Movement, it was a solid Democratic South. 1964, 65 comes along, Lyndon Johnson says, we pass this legislation, we're going to lose the South to the Republicans for the foreseeable. And that's exactly what happened, of course. Southern evangelicalism is simply a part of that society. You know, you can't really divide one thing from the other. I think something like 37% of Southerners are evangelicals. And that's a lot compared to, you know, the rest of the country. So one certainly feeds into the other. My view is that the religious right is going to continue. It's going to continue as a Southern party. That evangelicals elsewhere, and there are pockets of them. I mean, there are pockets of religious right folk. Elsewhere, particularly in the sort of Appalachian and southern parts of the Middle West, but that it's going to be this Southern party that remains, you know, to the right for a very long time, and we've seen what it's done to the Republican Party, which is interesting. I mean, by turning Republican, it's driven all the Northerners away. Has been a great reaction. So this hasn't been, you know, Nixon's Southern strategy was not, in the long run, perhaps the great thing for the Republican Party to do. Okay, let's go to the second one, which is about sort of commercialization. I was talking again last week, it was part of this, you know, part of what makes evangelicals look different from liberal Protestants, simply tremendous acceptance of popular culture right within the church, you know, Christian rock and roll music and video screens and you know, this pastor that I did a piece about who was starting a mega church in Connecticut. I mean, he, like many others, has a sort of whole coffee shop in his church. When the big football game, what is it called, comes along, Super Bowl, he has it in his church, and there's an extraordinary thing. They're called Bible zines. They're magazines that for most of them are for young women, although I think there's one that's for boys, that look from the outside like, you know, fashion magazines. They have dimpled girl, pretty hair, whatever, on the cover. And you go inside, and there's a whole lot of advice about dating, not dating, hair and makeup, you know, the whole sort of fashion thing for young girls, and right down the center of it is the text of the Bible. So these girls are carrying this thing as if they're not carrying the Bible. It's in the middle. Then there are these comments about biblical verses from these editors who nobody knows who they are, you know, and they're not pastors or anything. But this seems to me like the perfect sort of meld of things that are going on. The sacred and the secular cannot be kept apart anymore in this country, for any of us, I think. I think just some of us have accepted it sooner than later. But with the evangelicals, it comes out in these very amazingly explicit ways. And so that's part of what interests me about evangelicals, because things that are happening in other parts of the society are made kind of explicit. Yeah. Yeah. Well, first of all, it is true that mainline Protestantism is shrinking, and actually there's a new American Religious Identification Survey, which is the big one, that just came out the other day, which showed an absolutely drastic shrinkage. I mean, they've been holding at about 18% of the population for the past 20 years or so. Now they're now down to 12%, according to this survey. Evangelicals have been growing in numbers, but not really keeping pace with the population growth. They've been declining as a percentage of the population. The big growth area is among seculars, which is now was I think in the beginning of this century 12%. It's now up to 18%. Just in, 8 years. And I think that they are coming, I mean, that's where the liberal churches are losing their members to, is to secularism. I think what's happening in the evangelical world is that they're not losing members so much, but they're losing members to this internal secularization, which we were just talking about. These mega churches where you know, you can go there for a long time without really hearing any theology or any doctrine or anything. You know, it's about feeling good and being nice to your children and, you know, all kinds of nice messages. But it's not about church as we think of it. But the Southern Baptists, for example, are very worried about their declining share of the population. And if anyone's growing, it's the Pentecostals. Do you think people...
One more?
Sarah.
What do you think the economic downturn will affect the evangelicals?
I don't think much, actually. I mean, it's the conversation changes. The conversation, if you listen to it in the blogosphere or whatever... and obviously, evangelicals are as worried as the rest of us are about about the economy. So there's a certain shift of emphasis, but
and
the amount of money that goes into the plate. Yeah, absolutely. But that's true of every group. Some say, "Oh well, everybody flocks to church when there's economic downturn." I don't think that's the case. It wasn't true in the 30s, as far as I can tell. And the time people really started flocking to church was in the 50s, when the economy was going up. I think partly people were establishing families then, and all kinds of other things were happening. But I don't see this really as changing, except, as I say, as a matter of emphasis. I mean, you know, sort of like, don't bother me about gay rights right now. You know. Okay.